This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Jonathan Zimmerman, author of Too Hot to Handle, A Global History of Sex Education, compares and contrasts how sex ed was first introduced in the United States, the Soviet Union, Sweden, Mexico, and other countries. While the approach in this country was prevention, it was more about pleasure in places like Sweden. Sex education, especially in schools, has always been contentious and controversial in this country. Zimmerman predicts it will remain that way, especially with the influx of immigrants who tend to have more conservative values than many native-born Americans. Today on Radio Times, a history and the pros and cons of sex education, and later a program that includes teenagers and their parents together talking about sex. Jonathan Zimmerman is a professor of education history and director of the History of Education program, the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. A lot of education there, Jonathan Zimmerman. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
So what inspired you to write this book about sex education, not here in the United States, but from a global perspective?
Well, there are professional and personal answers to that, as always. I've spent my career studying the way that different people conceive of education and what happens when those conceptions differ. And so sex ed was a natural on those grounds. But on a more personal and slightly embarrassing front, my mother spent her career as a sex educator and a family planning advocate. And so in some ways, I grew up with the subject. I grew up hearing about it and thinking about it.
Does that mean that your mom would talk to you about sex as a kid growing up?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think
unusual.
And especially in the 1970s, you know, I have a huge amount of respect for what my mother accomplished. And I have a huge amount of agreement with her approach with me. Of course, not everybody is her or me.
Right.
And one of the ways my mom and I differ, I think, is she thinks that our system should be normative for everybody.
What was her approach, since you mentioned
well,
that?
Well, if you have to know, when I was about 15 or 16, my mom came home from work one day with a big box of condoms. And she said, I don't know what you and your friends are doing, but if it involves that, it's got to involve this. My mother's first name is Margot, with a silent T. And so to tease her, my friends would call her Margot. And across my suburban high school in Washington, D.C., condoms became known as Margots. And so people will saddle up to me in the hallway.
You're a very popular fellow,
yeah, they
right?
would say, Zim, I was known as Zim. You got any Margots? And I would say, yeah, come with me. And I had them in my locker. And I should tell you, as I said before, that this makes utter sense to me. And I can also say it worked. I think like a lot of people who grew up in the 70s, I did a lot of stupid things that I hope my own daughters haven't done, but some of them they probably have. But the one stupid thing I didn't do was I didn't have unprotected sex. So, you know, props to mom. It worked. It worked for me. But one of the reasons I wrote the book is to see how and whether it can work for others. And that's where it gets extraordinarily complicated. And that's where my mom and I differ. I think my mom's view, and if she's listening, I hope she'll correct me. My mom's view is, look, it worked for you. You know, the proof's in the pudding. All we need to do is to do something like that for everybody else. But I think given everything we know about human diversity, especially in the so-called age of globalization, I don't think that flies.
Well, what you also seem to conclude, and I do want to talk about specific countries and certainly how sex education got started in this country, which is, from your perspective, schools are not necessarily the best place to teach sex ed.
Well, right. I mean, I should just say right off the bat that, you know, the United States has 14,000 school districts. So, you know, one of the things that makes it both so fascinating and so scary to write about American education is it's such a multi-headed beast.
Right.
So obviously we're generalizing across a massive amount of diversity. I do think it's fair to say that because the subject has been so contentious and contended, it's been extremely limited in its scope and duration. And I think we do have evidence that other kinds of projects that are privately funded and driven, like the one we'll hear about involving Julie Metzger, right, have more success.
Interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of sex education. Let's start in this country. You say it really happened in what's called the progressive movement. This is the early 20th century. I guess what, related to World War I in some way?
Yes, and even before then. I mean, actually, it began amidst these big venereal disease outbreaks in cities like New York and Chicago. put briefly, what was happening was middle-class men were patronizing prostitutes, which has always been a major conduit for sexually transmitted disease, and going home and infecting their wives. And this created a huge panic, and very much of a racialized one. Let's remember this was also the era of eugenics, which was the so-called science, now we know it isn't, of human breeding. And it was felt that if white people did this, they were committing what was called race suicide because it led to infertility and other kinds of problems. And so there were many answers to this problem, but the American answer was education. And I do think that made us different at the time because obviously in cities like Paris and Berlin, the same venereal disease problem exists.
Sure.
But the solutions there tend to be legal ones. You know, we need to regulate prostitution more strictly or interdict it more strictly or register prostitutes. There was some of that here in the United States, but there was also this educational dimension. The idea was that the solvent, the solution, lay not just in the legal realm, but in the educational one.
Well, and was spearheaded by the American Social Hygiene Association, which tells you what their thinking was, that this was a matter of, and in certain ways, venereal diseases are about hygiene, are they not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And also about the collectivity, right? About, you know, obviously it was called the race, but also, you know, the society. That's one of the things that made sex ed a progressive movement, was they're trying to get individuals to behave in more socially approved and socially healthy ways, which is what hygiene was.
And was it a matter of scaring people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also, again, trying to ward off negative outcomes. And
right.
I would argue that that's the consistent theme throughout in the United States. You know, the idea is we want to prevent STDs and we want to prevent teen pregnancies. We want to prevent these collective negative outcomes. And we want to try to educate individuals so that they will bring that collective rate down.
And did it work back then? Is there any way to know?
There really isn't. And I would say in the United States, up until now, there really isn't, precisely because sex ed has been so haphazard and so limited. You know, sex ed is different than most other parts of the school curriculum because in most of the parts of the school curriculum, you're just trying to enhance people's knowledge and understanding. But in the United States, the goal of sex ed has been behavioral. It's been not just to teach people facts or understanding, it's to actually alter what they do. And it turns out that human sexuality and sexual behavior is an extraordinarily complicated matter.
Mm.
And if a kid is getting a total of 5 or 10 hours of sex ed throughout high school, to even as a matter of social science attribute their choices and their behavior to this extremely limited amount of sex education, it's highly problematic.
Well, and it seems as there's always been this sort of tension between prevention and promotion, right? That if you talk about the pleasures of sex, then that is labeled as promotion.
Right. And we don't talk about the pleasures of sex generally in American public schools. You know, Julie Metzger will in her private enterprises, but we don't do that. And I think that that, too, is rooted in the history. Because the goal was to prevent VD and really prevent sex, especially in the early 20th century, we taught sex ed via plant and animal metaphors precisely for the reason you're implying. You know, we didn't want to spark interest in the humankind, right? In most dimensions of schooling, especially in the progressive era, if you think about so-called progressive education, you want to harness kids' interests. And the other thing you want to do is you want to promote activity because kids learn by doing, right? Not in sex ed. This is like learning for not doing. And, you know, not interest. The last thing we want to do is to spark interest in it. And that's why it was often taught through, you know, the pollination of flowers and, you know, the mating
of
rabbits.
All these metaphors. Let me ask you about a couple of other countries. What I found was fascinating was the very beginning of the Soviet Union, I guess, how the Bolsheviks thought about sex education.
Yes. I mean, it's a complicated story.
Glass of water theory.
Yes,
right?
Because very briefly after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, there's an extremely libertine sex ed experiment done in the schools where they do things like they ask the kids how often they masturbate and put charts on comparing male and female rates. And they survey them about what kind of sexual practices are most pleasurable to them. The glass of water theory, promulgated by some members of the Bolshevik regime, was that satisfying a sexual impulse should be as simple and as problem-free as, you know, satisfying your thirst or quenching your thirst. You drink water. But Vladimir Lenin, of all people, was highly critical of this, which is one reason it came to an end.
Huh.
And he said, you know, you wouldn't drink water from a puddle now, would you? or from a glass that lots of other people had drunk water from. And so this is extremely limited. And even before Lenin dies, the Soviet Union shifts gears very rapidly, and the sex ed becomes both highly restrictive, highly limited, because the theory is that if kids become interested in sex, then that will divert them from their revolutionary duties.
I mean, that really was the thing.
Oh, and when we get into Mao's China, the same thing. I mean, why do you think, you know, all the cadres in communist China, the female cadres, had to wear these outfits that were, you know, covered up or disguised all of their secondary sexual characteristics? Again, the goal is the same. You know, if we think about sex, we'll be selfish, right? We'll be thinking about ourselves and our own needs instead of the whole, instead of the revolution. And so after this very brief moment of Bolshevik libertinism, sex ed in the Soviet Union became extremely, extremely restricted, very much in the just say no idiom. So much that during the Cold War, one of the things we said about the Soviet Union was that over there they can't talk about sex at all.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because they're such prudes.
Oh, they're such It's always interesting history. How about places like Sweden? I mean, were there countries, and we're talking about back in the day, but were there countries in the early days of sex education that were willing to talk about pleasure and relationship even?
Especially after the Second World War. You know, the United States is the pioneer of sex ed around the world, in part because the United States was the pioneer of mass secondary ed. You know, more kids go to high school here than any other place on earth in the early 20th century. So it kind of makes sense because sex ed is targeted adolescents. But then as more kids go to high school in Europe, sex ed catches on there. But what's fascinating about it is after the Second World War, some countries, especially Sweden, which was a pioneer in its own right, start to adopt a sex ed with a very different set of goals. And the goal is much more targeted at the individual and helping the individual develop and determine a healthy sexual life. And obviously pleasure is a huge part of that. And so it's not so much targeted at warding off negative collective outcomes. It's targeted at promoting positive individual ones.
Which I think tells you about the country, right? I mean, it's a reflection of the country's culture.
Well, yes, and I think sex ed always is. But in this case, Marty, I'd say that actually, the sex ed story runs counter to so many other transatlantic comparisons that we tend to tell, in which the United States is all about the individual. And the Western European societies are much more oriented towards the collectivity. I would argue in sex ed, it was actually the reverse. That, you know, our sex ed was and remains very much oriented towards the society and these things called rates, right? VD rate, pregnancy rate. A rate is a collective outcome, right? And in Sweden, which was the first country to require sex ed nationwide, much more targeted at helping the individual grow, develop, experience sex.
We're going to take a very short break, and then we're going to get back to our conversation. That's Jonathan Zimmerman, our guest in this hour of the show. He teaches at New York University, and he's also written a new book. It's called Too Hot to Handle, A Global History of Sex Education. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can send us a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. Tell us about your sex education. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Jonathan Zimmerman. He has taken a global look at sex education in his new book called Too Hot to Handle. He traces the beginnings of sex about 100 years ago, which we were just talking about, and he also shows how sex ed has been shaped by things like culture and world events. I'm thinking about the AIDS epidemic and specifically, I mean, it affected all countries, but it particularly affected the continent of Africa and a number of countries in that a number of countries on that continent. How do you see, I guess, shaping sex education, broadly speaking, in places in Africa?
Well, you know, AIDS changed everything, obviously, in the United States and the world. And it changed sex ed quite dramatically because before AIDS, some people were for sex ed and other people were against it. And some countries had sex ed and others didn't. And HIV changes that because the epidemic is so rapid and so tragic and so brutal that almost every country adopts some kind of sex ed. And even in our own country, people who had formerly said that the school shouldn't be addressing the subject, they changed their tune. I mean, you know, everyone should realize abstinence-only sex ed is sex ed. Right? And
absolutely,
the purveyors of abstinence-only sex ed pre-HIV, they didn't want the schools to have anything to do with sex. Their argument was that sex is a parental and a familial matter.
AIDS changed that?
Completely. Right? So now almost nobody says we shouldn't have sex ed. Instead, what they do is they debate what form the sex ed should take. And on the continent of Africa, which obviously was the greatest victim of AIDS and remains so, almost every country adopted some kind of sex ed or HIV curriculum. Their hand was forced.
And do we see abstinence only? Do we see that around the world as a kind of response to the threat of AIDS?
Very much so. So when the African countries adopt sex ed, almost all of them, and South Africa is a notable exception, but almost all the others, they adopt something that is much closer to the abstinence-only model than, say, to the Swedish model. Something that's fascinating about the Swedes is they sent educators around the world trying to promote their version of sex ed. And I think it's fair to say that in most parts of the so-called third world, it fell on deaf ears. The Swedish model is all about individual sexual autonomy. It's all about adolescents as sexual beings and helping them develop their sexual lives. And I think that's a very hard sell in a culture and a faith system where those kinds of choices are not left open to the individual.
In fact, what I found really interesting in your book is looking at how globalization has affected sex education. So you've got people migrating around the world, moving into a country, let's say the United States, coming from a developing to a developed country. There's a good chance they're bringing their more conservative views, as we would define them, about sex and sex education.
Absolutely. You know, when I started to look at this phenomenon of globalization and what had been written about it, I found a lot of it quite dissatisfying because it seemed that the assumption was often that globalization is going to yield something that I like, whoever I am. It's going to yield liberalization. It's going to yield some sort of cosmopolitanism, one big happy family. And this strikes me as utterly facile. And the sex ed story shows precisely the opposite. If globalization means the rapid movement of people and ideas across borders, what it did was it inhibited, it stymied sex education because, you know, societies like Sweden, which had formerly been rather monochrome, very suddenly become extremely diverse. We think in Sweden now there are about 10 million people and 1 million of them were born in another country.
Wow.
Sweden is fractionally more of an immigrant society than the United States. But that's a very recent vintage, right? Unlike the United States, Sweden didn't begin as an immigrant society. Most of these immigrants come from the subcontinent or the Middle East or North Africa. And like you said, they bring, many of them, relatively conservative views of sex ed to the new nation. And that makes sex ed in a place like Sweden, where it formerly had been not particularly controversial, hugely so.
Does it say that schools just perhaps shouldn't be in the business of sex education if it's going to be a place of conflict and controversy?
Well, I wouldn't go that far personally, but I would say it's fair to say that what globalization has done is it's made sex education more contested and more contended than it's ever been. It's also created really interesting political alliances between these newcomers, often with very conservative sexual ideas, and native-born right-wingers. So in the UK, you find these interesting alliances between recently arrived, you know, Muslims from Pakistan and these white conservative Tories who generally agree
Who come together on
right.
sex ed.
They don't agree about anything, including immigration itself, because often in these societies, it's the white right wing that wants to close the door. But in this question, the door's open, and every journalistic account that I've found of these alliances uses the headline "Strange Bedfellows." It seems to be some new law of the newspaper. I've never seen an account that doesn't because it's a perfect
irresistible.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's a perfect metaphor.
I don't know how many years ago Heather has as Two Mommies was published. But it's interesting to think about sex education when there's so much more talk about gender identity, when there's more gay marriage. How do you see that sort of either creating tensions within the classroom or maybe opening up a discussion about sex education?
Well, those are two different questions. I mean, I think that, you know, the issue of gay rights and gay marriage has opened up an enormous discussion, you know, all over the world in our society and others. But I think within public school sex ed, it's yet another huge bone of contention. So in the UK, there were Muslim immigrants who pulled their kids out of school and demonstrated outside these schools when sex ed was taught. And one of their major talking points was that the school is talking about homosexuality. And in Islam, this is a sin. It's punishable sometimes by death. And that's what they said. And they said, so why should our kids be exposed to that in a state school?
Which, you know, what's the answer to that? I mean, how do you resolve a conflict like that?
Well, you know, I think that it's, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book is precisely, I think, to engage all of us in that dialogue. You know, I think that, you know, the first lesson of the book is that sex ed happens in a million different places.
Right.
It doesn't just happen in public schools. And in fact, when we survey kids across the past century, one of the things they tell us is very few of them learn about sex in schools. So I think one thing the book suggests is that, you know, we're going to learn a lot more from people like Julie Metzger, who's about to join us, than we are from public school sex ed teachers. And that because of these clashes that you're referring to, we'll probably have much more success in sparking the discussions that you also referred to if we do so outside of a public school context.
And one hears about the gym teacher, you know, who gets to teach sex ed, which, you know, it's I'm not sure whether people are standing in line to do this or whether it's, you know, the last pick.
Well, right. I mean, that's another theme of the book. I mean, you know, it in many countries of the world, it's asking a lot of teachers who may have 60 or 70 kids in a classroom of different ages and abilities to also address a subject that historically and traditionally hasn't been addressed at all,
right,
especially if they're female teachers. You know, there's an awful catch-22. You know, if you're too old, you're an old maid and you haven't experienced enough of this subject to talk about it. And if you're too young and you're talking about it, you're like a hussy. You know, look, you know, teachers are sexual beings. And so if they're teaching sex ed, it's going to be difficult to avoid that. But that also is a hugely perilous terrain,
sure,
in many parts of the world.
Well, and I think in this part of the world as well, don't you think?
Everywhere.
I mean, it's about values and, again, this sort of promotion-prevention dichotomy.
Right, right. And you know, if we're talking about a subject, it's quite a natural question for a kid to say, now, wait a second, Ms. or Mr. So-and-so, like, what do you do?
Right. What do you know about this?
Yeah, not just what do you know about it, right, but what have you experienced about it? How much learning by doing have you done?
Let me reintroduce you. That's Jonathan Zimmerman, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's the author of a new book called Too Hot to Handle, A Global History of Sex Education. I do want to open the lines at 1-888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you if you have some ideas about how to improve sex education. I think we can all agree it does need some improvement. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. You say back, and this is, 20 years ago, there was this watershed, I guess, meeting, the International Conference on Population and Development. It was meeting in Cairo back in 1994. How did that, I guess, sort of either change the conversation about sex or sex ed or you know, make it even more intense than it already was?
Yeah, I mean, I think Cairo, which is, you know, 21 years ago, is really where the culture war over sex ed goes global. The reason is that one of the resolutions that's passed by this convention says that adolescents are reproductive beings and therefore they have a right to knowledge about sex. And there are 7 countries that dissent. One of them is the host of the conference, the country of Egypt. Four others are majority Muslim countries, and then there are 2 Catholic countries, majority Catholic countries in Central America, and the Vatican. The Holy See sends a papal representative to Tehran to coordinate opposition to this resolution, which I think tells you something really interesting about these new configurations. So sex ed has been a global phenomenon, but the opposition to sex ed is also global. it has been globalized. Globalization is not just going to bring liberalization. It's going to bring new alliances of every political stripe.
And is it because when we talk about sex, we talk about, you know, the potential for reproduction? I mean, that it's sort of loaded and obviously comes with some responsibilities if someone does get pregnant or not.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Iranian delegate at the conference, he says, look, you know, the problem with this this resolution, it's not that we're against reproduction. We're all about that. You know, it's that the resolution implies that people should have knowledge about this before they're married. And in our faith system, in the Islamic Republic, sex belongs within the marital union, and any kind of sex that occurs outside of that is tabooed. Mm.
Does sex ed work?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you run the experiment exactly.
Yeah, and that's the problem. I mean, you know, it's so brief in a country like ours that answering that question as a matter of social science turns out to be extraordinarily difficult. In fairness, we do have some glimmers of knowledge that there are certain programs that have been successful, but how to scale them up as a social scientist say, we don't know. And I think it's also fair to say that because sex ed has been so limited, if you hear anyone on any side of the political spectrum say sex ed does X behaviorally in terms of teen sexual behavior, if they're saying it with absolute certitude, I think it's pretty fair to write them off as an ideologue and a charlatan.
Because you're saying we just can't say that.
And I'm saying that on both sides. So if you hear somebody the right say, oh, sex ed makes the kids have sex.
Right.
Or somebody the left say, you know, sex ed makes the kids use condoms.
Right.
If they're saying it with certitude, you should be extremely skeptical because we have so little sex ed, really, that, you know, proving either of those assertions turns out to be extraordinarily difficult.
Are there, though, with all these caveats, are there, do you think, programs even within schools, and we will be talking about things outside of school, but within schools that have at least showed some modicum of success?
Oh, without a doubt. And, you know, the best scholar of this was a guy named Doug Kirby, who very tragically died recently. And, you know, Doug was able to find, you know, a couple places where it did seem like if you expose kids to certain messages and you engage them in certain discussions, they did behave in more sexually responsible ways. Mm-hmm. Either they delayed the, having sex, or when they had sex, they did so in a protected fashion. But again, I think it's fair to say we have very few such examples, and we don't really have a knowledge base about how we could scale those examples into a broader public policy.
You mentioned people that take a hard line on this stuff, you know, be suspicious, be aware. What about abstinence only? And I've heard both sides that people are virgins when they get married, and I've also heard people say no, they go to college and they go wild.
Yeah.
Have you looked at this?
Yeah, again, you know, obviously I'm a historian, I'm not a social scientist, but I did have to read all this social science in the course of doing the book. And I think again there, you know, the knowledge base is extremely slim, you know. We don't have a lot of evidence that exposing kids to abstinence only messages makes them more likely to abstain. Again, there have been a couple little glimmers here and there, but for somebody just to get in front of a microphone and say, oh, absolutely, you teach them abstinence-only sex ed and mm-hmm. then they stay away from sex, that's preposterous. We just don't have that evidence.
As you said earlier, and this should come as no surprise to anybody, teens or young people tend to learn about sex from mass media, from the internet.
And that's been a constant since before the internet. So we did surveys of kids in the United States in the 20s. Where do you get your sexual information? And, the answers have been over time, they've been peers. They've been mass media, and at that time in the 20s, kind of the golden age of Hollywood, it was the silver screen, right? And then sometimes parents, but schools have always been, you know, between about 7 and 3%. And although some of the other percentages have changed, that one hasn't. School has never been, you know, more than 8-9% of the kids identifying that as a primary place where they get sexual knowledge.
I keep coming back to the same thing then. So why are schools and, you know, being asked to do this?
Well, you know, I think actually part of that answer just has to do with the conception, the broader conception of school that we've developed in the past 100 years, and what we've asked it to do. You know, the old joke now, it is that, you know, when American society gets an itch, school's got to scratch it. Mm-hmm. So the kids are drinking. We got alcohol education. Kids are using narcotics. We have drug education. The kids are in gangs, right? We've got anti-gang education.
They're driving, right?
Yes, that's right. Now the kids are driving. Or you know, if you want to get into more nitty-gritty, you know, we've got a serious environmental problem, so we need environmental education, right? You know, we need to use the school to intervene in all these other social problems and realms. And I think sex ed is part of that trend.
Let me see if I can squeeze a caller on before we have to take a very short break. We have Jeanette, and Jeanette calling us on Radio Times. Jeanette, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My question is specifically about a subgroup of
Ooh, I think we just lost her for some reason. Jeanette was talking about actually for perhaps people on the autism spectrum, but also thinking about sex ed for a variety of kids. Have you thought about that or looked at that?
Yeah, and you know, there's an interesting literature about that because, you know, as we've gotten more awareness and more understanding of disability, one of the things we've learned is that our sex ed messages have not been very well tailored to people with different disabilities. And I think that, you know, there's, a new awareness of that. And again, I think some very interesting experiments and examples of trying to tailor these messages to people with different needs.
Did you have sex ed as a kid growing up, like in high school or
junior
high school? Oh, yeah.
And I'll join the rest of most of America in saying that it was a complete joke. You know, there are jokes about sex ed, by the way, Marty, in every society. And
yes.
You don't have to be Freud.
Right?
You don't have to be Freud to see why that would be. And the joke's always on the adult. Can I tell one?
Yes.
This is my favorite one actually comes from
45 seconds.
Favorite one comes from Sweden. Again, it's required nationally in Sweden, and they're very proud of that. So the joke goes like this. A teacher gets in front of a group of 8-year-olds and says, okay, we're going to start sex ed now, have our first lesson. And a boy in front raises a hand and says, Miss, can those of us who already know how to ... go outside to play soccer? and again, the joke is always on the adult. You know, the adult who has this fantasy that the kids have somehow been insulated from that subject and now we're going to enlighten them. When in fact, the kids have already received thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of messages about this subject from a variety of other places, not school.
That's Jonathan Zimmerman. He's a professor of education and history, also director of the History of Education program. That's at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development, and that's at New York University. And he's the author of this new book called Too Hot to Handle, A Global History of Sex Education. And Julie Metzger is waiting in the wings. She's a nurse, co-founder of something called Great Conversations. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen. I've been talking with Jonathan Zimmerman. He's been giving us a global history of sex education. Julie Metzger has been listening. She joins us now. She's a nurse and co-founder of Great Conversations. It's a organization that features classes and presentations on subjects dealing with sexuality, sex, puberty, parenting, and other topics. What's interesting about this group is that the moms and their daughters sit together and are part of the conversation. And boys and their fathers and their sons are together in a different kind of conversation. Julie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's been a great conversation. Jonathan, your book is fabulous. Wonderful discussion.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
That's excellent.
Julie, I was looking at some of the videos on your website yesterday, and I was watching you in action, if I can put it that way. And you have great energy, great openness, great humor, playfulness. Mm. How important is it, just the sort of tone and attitude of that person who is leading a class or a program in sex education?
Well, we've had a lot of fun building a program that sort of breaks down some of what people expect when they walk in the room. And I think a lot of people are expecting to have someone in a white coat, perhaps, and be very serious. And one of the things that we've done is brought in storytelling and humor and yet sort of I would call it an irreverent reverence for the topic, so that people are surprised by the tone and character of the class, and they relax and settle in to just a really great evening together.
Well, and this is not obviously part of the public school curriculum. This is people sign up to do this, Julie. But what's interesting to me is that you include the parents with the children. These are like young adolescents or teenagers. What is the thinking behind that?
Well, my graduate work was at the University of Washington School of Nursing, was looking at women's experience of learning about menarche, the starting their periods, puberty, sex, and many of those women said, you know, a little bit of school, a little bit of my friends on the playground, and a little bit my parents. Right. And I thought, isn't that so amazing that just picturing those parent conversations, they were anything from this is the worst moment of my entire life to I've been waiting for this moment my entire life, 45-minute conversations, 2 minutes, 10 seconds, and all filled with myths and truths mixed in together. Right. And what if you created a class where you actually sat together? And what if you walked away with the entire class learning things together, having a shared moment, and then you walk away saying, that was way different than I thought it was going to be, and now we've had this shared event, let's continue the conversation going forward. And that's been the whole thinking. I thought for the first 10 years of teaching this class, I was talking to the kids. But I realized, I don't know, it's just this wake up that I wasn't really talking to the kids. I was really talking to the parents, because the parents are walking in hungry to learn how to have these conversations with their kids, and they don't have a starting place, a natural starting place. The class itself becomes a natural starting place to get in the car or even a week later saying, hey, remember that class? It's a point of reference that they have together.
And I do want to pick up on that. Let me give Jonathan Zimmerman a chance to weigh in. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple fascinating things going on here. I mean, first of all, I yield to nobody in my respect for Julie Metzer and what she's accomplished. And I think if you listen to her biography, you'll see that it's fair to call her a sex expert. She might not like to call herself that, but obviously...
Oh, I like calling myself.
It's good to be an expert,
okay,
isn't it?
Then the shoe fits. But more seriously, I mean, the gym teacher that taught me sex ed at Leland Junior High School did not have the expertise that Julie Metzger has, right?
Or maybe the comfort.
Neither, right? And obviously they're related because knowledge makes us more comfortable. But, you know, historically, our listeners should know, the reason gym teachers teach phys ed is that historically it was gender segregated, and it was felt that you could only do sex ed in a gender segregated environment. And also, you know, after the advent of the mass high school, when we start tracking, right, having different, you know, skill levels and different tracks, gym is one of the only shared subjects, right? Not everybody take calculus, but if you want sex ed to be universal, you have to have it in a universal subject. So that's why your gym teacher taught you sex ed. And, you know, most of them don't have the background, the experience, the knowledge, the thoughtfulness that Julie Metzger exhibits.
Well, and Julie, your classes are gender segregated as well.
Well, right. We talk to 10 to 12-year-olds, and that particular age group, there's sort of a comfort level in getting started in the conversation. We would never say that would be the only way to do it. It was just a way to get this conversation started. You also mentioned that girls come with mothers, but it's really a parent.
A parent.
We keep it a single parent just so that it's not twice as many adults in the room.
Right.
And we have about 150 people in the room at a time. So it's a very big classroom type space. So it's girls and a parent, and then boys and a parent. And then we start off with talking about that particular gender's experience of puberty. And there's a real comfort level for both genders to hear about some of those things sitting amongst their people.
And what's so interesting to me is that I guess the children largely ask the questions. I guess it sounds like the adults or the parents, you know, listen to those questions. Are there certain themes that you have found in your work, Julie?
Oh, yeah. If you took the 27 years of teaching this class and literally tens of thousands of people having gone through it, I can actually put the questions in boxes. There are about four big boxes. One box is this normal? Am I beautiful? Is this body going to work well?
Right.
The second question that gets asked is, what are all these feelings that I have and how will I work with that? What are the, I feel a million things at once, and how will I kind of navigate through that? The third big question that people ask relates to their social life of, will I fit in? How will I fit in? Will I be important and included with others? And what is a crush? All those things kind of fall into that. And then the last question is there anything else I need to know about all these things?
Right.
And of course, the answer there is yes.
Always yes.
And, yeah, and it's so fascinating. Again, you know, props to Julie Metzger, but I think there are many places in the United States and Canada and around the world where introducing some of the subjects she introduces would get a teacher fired, you know, or just, you know, get a big protest outside the school. So, you know, recently this flared in Toronto, you know, a heavily multicultural city where the school district proposed a new sex ed curriculum that included mentions of sexting.
And sexting,
yes,
right.
via text message. And, you know, what is that? Why do people do it? Should I do it? Personally, I think that's an entirely legitimate, indeed, I would say necessary subject. But it created a massive protest in Toronto. And if you go on to the Facebook page of People Against Sex Ed, you'll see that, lo and behold, it includes evangelical white Protestant Christians and lots of newcomers from, you know, South Asia, the Middle East. That strange bedfellow effect, and people saying, you know, hey, this thing about dating, you know what? We don't date, right?
You know, can I add in?
Go ahead, Julie.
Two ideas together that you've brought up, Jonathan. One is being a sex expert, and then one is this really diverse room. In any single room, I know that someone, there's a parent, they're sitting, they're absolutely praying that I will not say the word sex out loud. And then there's
just
there. Yes.
Yeah.
In the same room, every night, not without exception, even though they've paid to come and or, you know, we've scholarship funded them to come, they've chosen to come, there's someone saying, I hope they don't say the word sex out loud, and someone saying, I will be offended if they don't describe a sexual act that I enjoy that only 0.001 of the population even right. knows about. And so actually, given that giant diversity, I think that we have a very thin trail to walk. And we get very, very, very good at knowing how to walk down that trail right. with so that everybody walks out feeling honored.
Mm-hmm.
And that is tough to do if you're only going to do that for 2 hours in a health
in a year.
Class in a high school
right.
when you're also teaching basketball. That is almost impossible.
Yeah.
I mean,
we
the other thing, Julie.
Very, very good at knowing that thin, thin line that we're walking down so that everybody walks out saying, she talked about us, our family there. I could hear it. Or there was room for me there. I didn't feel violated or afraid. I felt
right.
honored.
Which I applaud 1,000%. But I just want our listeners to realize, if they just tuned in, that these terrific seminars and workshops you run, even if a parent there is skeptical, the parent is still there on a voluntary basis.
For sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So are the kids. And that's just – that makes it absolutely different from a public school setting.
The kids are not often there on the
right.
court. Let's,
exactly.
let's
right.
clarify that.
Right.
There's definitely some reluctant participants when they first walk in.
Oh, right, right. But in that case, they were required to be there by a parent, not by the state.
Right, of course.
Right.
And I'm sure, Julie, you've been asked the question by children, by these kids, you know, how do you know when you want to have sex? I mean, that's
yes.
the sort of most basic question, and I'm sure right. on the minds of probably the children and their parents. How do you answer that?
That's a, you know, there's no one sentence answer to that because we build towards that question. It's a 4-hour curriculum. We build towards that question, and I consider that question sort of the paramount moment of
right.
the class, where you sort of bring it all together. You bring it home. And I literally walk across the auditorium creating a sort of continuum of decision making in all relationships, from interacting with a complete stranger all the way to having sexual intercourse with someone. And as I walk across that auditorium, you sort of build the case using the language that we've been sharing together all along so that people can visually see how our emotions, the actions we choose within those relationships, and the consequences that occur from those actions sort of build across that continuum. And then we go back and forth across that continuum for the next 15 minutes, trying to help those 10 to 12-year-olds see how they get to choose how they bring their action choice together with the relationship that they're comfortable with. It's really powerful, but it's not a one sentence thing.
Right.
You're culminating to this moment by building their trust and then giving them a visual representation of how they would fit in with that. And there's a real sense of relief and understanding when they have a chance to see and experience that, because they say, well, I know where I am on that, and I see where my parents are, or I now that fits in, versus feeling bombarded or hit straight on with thinking, how would I make that decision at 12?
And hopefully the parent and the child can carry on that conversation, because they've been a party to it, John.
Right. I mean, I want to endorse what Julie's doing, but I want to emphasize that this entire dialogue and this entire rhetoric of choice, of adolescent sexual choice, is anathema to millions, perhaps billions, of our fellow human beings. Mm. It doesn't make it wrong. I mean, my wife and I tried to raise our daughters in precisely this idiom: keep an open line, and two basic principles. The first one was, anything you do has to be your call, not somebody else's call.
Right.
And because of the disease environment, it does have to be protected. I mean, those were our two non-negotiables. But the second one's a lot easier than the first, right? What does the first mean? Okay, this has to be your call, not somebody else's. Okay, fine. How do I make that call?
Exactly.
And I think people like Julie are absolutely integral in helping our young people think through that. But I don't know how well public schools can do that.
Let me read a tweet from, it looks like Akir. Every 11 or 12-year-old should have a copy of Our Bodies, Ourselves. You know, if there's a version named Boys/Men. I grew up in a suburb of New York City. We had sex ed every year for a full period, three times a week, starting at seventh grade. It's mind-boggling to me how much teens now don't seem to know compared to what my peers and I were taught back in the 80s. If I can toss that to you, Julie, based on your conversations with young people, are you surprised about what they don't know, or perhaps some of the misinformation that they have about sex?
Well, I don't know that I'm ever surprised. I mean, we see so many families that they're all across the continuum. I sort of walk in expecting a wide range of understanding or a wide range of misinformation as well. So I think that, there's just certain exposures that people have. I mean, right now, what is it, like 80% of broadcast television has provocative sexual material on it, or they can get pornography in their back pocket on their phone. It's exposure and then questions and then what is actually knowledge is all kind of a mixing bowl. People come with all sorts of images and impressions.
Right. And look, there's a huge amount of misinformation on the net. And I would also add, I think it's fair to say, a huge amount of, you know, violent, deeply troubling imagery about sex. And I worry deeply about our young people, especially our young men, and the ideas they're getting about sex from those images. But whether school can challenge them, public school, I think, is a more complicated question. We've tried that for 100 years. I mean, during the era of the silver screen in the 1920s, that's what sex educators were doing. They were saying, I know you've seen these images on the screen, but it's not like that, or it shouldn't be like that. My own gut says that because the screens are so ubiquitous, that the best solutions are going to come from the screens themselves. And we already have some. You know, Planned Parenthood runs these text messaging things where you can just say, you text them a question and somebody who actually knows what they're talking about will respond. Fight fire with fire, fight screens with screens.
Well, and Julie,
we show people a picture of girls' anatomy looking at their perineum, so between their legs. And I say to the girls, who, of course, kind of reel back when they look at that at first, but I said, first of all, you just now have learned something that hundreds and hundreds of millions of girls will never know in their entire lifetime, and that it's their job to advocate for those girls for the rest of their lives, because they just now learned something that most girls on the planet actually do not know.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. It's been a great pleasure. Julie Metzger, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
great, great conversation.
Thanks so much. And she's the co-founder of Great Conversations. Jonathan Zimmerman, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks. It was fun.
It was fun for us. And the book is called Too Hot to Handle, A Global History of Sex Education. I should add that our guest, Jonathan Zimmerman, does commentary for Newsworks Tonight, and his commentary called That's History. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, and probably carry on a conversation on our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.